Nuclear activism. Yes, we want to get rid of nuclear weapons, nuclear reactors, the radioactive waste they leave behind. But how? It's hard to know where to start with nuclear, as there are so many horrific aspects to this hydra-headed monster technology. But now, an award-winning veteran environmental journalist has come out with a book that repurposes some of the more than 700 interviews he's conducted with leading scientists, doctors, activists, indigenous leaders, physicists, and so many others to create a book with the focus on what you can do activism and where you can start. It's filled with brilliant ideas put forward by some of the most brilliant minds working on behalf of the planet and its life forms. And this journalist tells you,
imagine that the guests on this show, they are speaking not only to me, Carl Grossman, but to you. They are asking you to listen, not passively, but actively. They are asking you to carry their words forward to ensure that truth is not buried, that courage is not forgotten, that hope is not extinguished. This book is not only an archive, it's an invitation to awareness, to responsibility, to action. And that's what this book is all about.
Well, when award-winning environmental journalist Carl Grossman presents you with a book containing the best of his decades of interviews on nuclear and environmental issues, one that is easy to understand and gives you small, manageable steps to take towards your activist goals, you begin to glimpse that there's a way to a future where we are freed from that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that right now we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a very special interview, an activism special, if you will, with award-winning environmental journalist Carl Grossman, the visionary who created the cable TV program Enviro Close-Up. In collaboration with his longtime producer, a filmmaker and award-winning documentarian in his own right, as well as a man who makes things happen and gets things done, Frank Melly, they share credit on the newly published book, Enviro Video, Book 1, repurposing the TV series into a handbook for action and change. It presents the insights, perceptions, and an undeniably powerful call to action from 14 international leaders who are fighting to preserve our environment, health, and life itself. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and lots more honest and verifiable nuclear information, all of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, May 26, 2026, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out with some good news here in the U.S., where California lawmakers have rejected the latest bid to lift a nuclear moratorium on new builds, a law that has now stood for 50 years. Hakan Williams, executive director of Committee to Bridge the Gap, which spearheaded the effort, said, "California's nuclear moratorium has always carried a clear condition. It may be lifted when there exists a way to dispose of the long-lived radioactive waste. It has now been 50 years since the state put that condition in place, and those decades have revealed it to be a wise policy. We are hardly any closer today than we were in 1976 to figuring out how to responsibly dispose of spent nuclear fuel, which remains dangerous for hundreds of thousands of years. Committee to Bridge the Gap was joined in this opposition by the Sierra Club of California, Union of Concerned Scientists, and other environmental and public interest groups. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has thrown in the towel to the White House, ceding its safety oversight mandate for risky new reactors to the promotion-oriented Department of Energy. Here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
If your vet told you to take your cat to a lawyer for its next checkup and that she would abide by whatever medical assessment the lawyer made of your cat, would you do it? Of course not. It's patently absurd, not to mention dangerous for the well-being of your feline friend. But that's exactly what the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission is proposing with its new rule. The NRC is effectively agreeing that any new reactor design given a clean bill of health by the US Department of Energy for military purposes will automatically be assumed safe for civil use as well, without the need for any safety scrutiny by the NRC. Never mind that the DOE is an entirely promotional entity that has neither the experience nor the staff to assess reactor safety, and never mind that what actually defines safe is nowhere spelled out in the NRC proposal, known as the rubber stamp rule. And never mind that the rubber stamp rule clearly violates key components of the Atomic Energy Act, which gives the NRC sole authority and responsibility for the licensing of commercial reactors. 13 organizations from across the U.S., led by my group Beyond Nuclear and by Nuclear Information and Resource Service, have filed comments on the NRC's surrender, pointing all of this out. Of particular concern is that the NRC intends, almost certainly illegally, to accept safety findings from other agencies without verifying whether they are correct, compliant with protection standards, or adequately supported. The NRC had already been stripped of a large part of its authority by the metaphorically axe-wielding Doge, that murky entity created by the unelected and now vanished Elon Musk, and which may or may not still exist. But even without Doge as its not-so-benevolent overlord, the NRC is all too happy to forfeit its authority to the White House. Meanwhile, the White House continues to do what it does best, demonstrate a complete disregard for the law, and we're not even talking end runs around the IRS here, or slush funds with which to reward family members and violent insurrectionists. NRC's proposed rule would create a kind of regulatory tunnel around its own established regulations and licensing processes. This would allow for DOE's promotional biases and incorrect conclusions about reactor safety and environmental impacts to become the new normal in the regulation of the civilian nuclear power industry, exposing the public to unacceptable dangers to our health and safety. 11 state attorneys general, in their own March 11 comment filing, had earlier agreed with civil society groups that such exclusions violate existing law. The AGs concurred that the NRC, not the DOE, has licensing authority over the commercial reactor demonstration projects that the DOE undertakes. But under the rubber stamp rule, new reactor companies would likely never have to go through a detailed safety review by the NRC to build and operate their reactors. In 1974, Congress amended the Atomic Energy Act to prohibit such a scheme when it abolished the promotion-oriented Atomic Energy Commission after it had lost the confidence of Congress and the public over safety. The NRC was instead established to provide a regulator that prioritizes safety and would not be obligated to take shortcuts in favor of an expedited production agenda over public safety. It should be said that despite that change, the NRC consistently drifted toward promoter versus regulator, has typically been more of an industry lapdog than watchdog, and tends to favor nuclear industry cost concerns over public safety. But even a weak regulator is better than none at all. Nuclear power is simply too inherently dangerous a technology to operate outside the law. Ignoring those dangers will put millions of Americans at risk of another catastrophic nuclear accident. I'm Linda Pence Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
Beyond Nuclear and Nuclear Information and Resource Service will hold a briefing by experts on Capitol Hill at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday, June 2nd. Among those testifying, Dr. Edmund Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, Peter Bradford, a former NRC chair, physicist M. V. Ramana, attorney Diane Curran, and others. Please let your members of Congress know by calling the Capitol Hill switchboard at 202-224-3121 to urge them or their staff to attend. And we will have a link up to that information on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 778. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of the week.
Earlier this year, researchers at King's College London gave three commercial AI models, GPT 5.2, Claude Sonnet 4, and Gemini 3 Flash, a tabletop exercise typically used to train human military strategists. Each system played the leader of a nuclear-armed country in a Cold War-style standoff. The researchers didn't instruct the models to escalate, nor did they tell them to win at all costs. They presented the models with a scenario and asked them to play it out. Across 21 simulations and 329 turns of play, the models chose to use tactical nuclear weapons in all but one game. No model in any run chose to surrender or make meaningful concessions. The models researchers used had the same built-in safety rules that are in place when conversing with millions of people every day. And the rules worked exactly as designed. As a result, no move was by itself concerning. But the overall direction of play was, and no mechanism was in place to catch the alarming trends. The same pattern, individually safe actions building towards a dangerous outcome, has also shown up across every major AI model. And that's why, those of you brainiacs who are in charge of maybe considering putting AI in charge of nukes, you are most definitely this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of the week.
Here's this week's featured interview. When is a book more than a book? When it's capable of becoming the cornerstone of our activism, providing facts, hope, encouragement, and strategies to turn around the Epstein class's greed that is destroying so much of life as it exists. It takes a veteran journalist and his veteran producer, award winners both, to come up with something this profound, powerful, and motivating, something that is both a time capsule and a guidebook. Enviro Video Book 1, Repurposing the TV Series into a Handbook for Action and Change, is the brainchild of journalist Carl Grossman and his producer, collaborator, and as I've said, a man who makes things happen, Frank Melli. Together they have presented Enviro Close-Up as a cable TV program since 1991. Here they have culled just a few of the most empowering interviews from that show. Not an easy task, given the quality and extensive quantity of the source material. What results is a powerful, yet easy-to-understand book with words of wisdom on every page and a spirit, a light, that heartens those who read it. They call it a time capsule and a guidebook. I consider it a miracle of clarity, motivation, and that powerful call to action. I spoke with Carl Grossman and Frank Melli on May 24, 2026. Carl Grossman and Frank Melli, thank you for joining us on Nuclear Hot Seat, and I have so been looking forward to this interview.
Wonderful to be here, Libby.
And we've been looking forward to it too, Libby.
Let's start out with some information about your show, Enviro Close-Up. What is it, when was it started, and how many episodes have been recorded?
Well, we began in 1991. We're now, in terms of the Enviro Close-Up with Carl Grossman series, 714 programs. We've also done documentaries, including Nukes in Space, the nuclearization and weaponization of the heavens and specials. So we've been going now for a long time and we're going to keep going.
How are the episodes available if people want to visit them?
Well, they can go to our website, envirovideo.com, and there they are, hundreds and hundreds of programs you can watch. In terms of actual broadcasting, the programs are syndicated by Free Speech TV. They're out of Denver and broadcast on nearly 200 cable TV systems in 40 states and on the major satellite television networks.
I'll make certain that there is a link up to your website on our page for this program, nuclearhotseat.com. This episode is number 778. So I've got a few more than you. The benefits of a weekly program. Frank, explain to us what your position has been with Enviro Close-Up through the years.
Back in 1991, when I met Carl and the other board members who were running EnviroVideo at the time, it was just a perfect connection. I was so into the environment, and I met them at a street festival in Manhattan on the Upper West Side. Steve and Joan were there, so I met them, and they introduced me to Carl. And it was Earth Day or environment, some beautiful event, and I was at the time a broadcast engineer and video editor. I started volunteering back in 1991. Since then, that's grown from editor to producer, director, editor, webmaster, liaison to the TV station, media manager, the whole list. And I'm so happy to be doing this work with Carl because it's not work. It's fun and it's useful and meaningful. It's an honor to be working with Carl and doing this work.
The Steve and Joan that Frank referred to, that's Steve Jambeck. And he was a shooter, he's retired now at NBC, including Saturday Night Live. And his wife, Joan Flynn, an activist with Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And that's been our basic team, Steve and Joan, Frank and me.
It's great that you have a team, speaking as someone who doesn't. Wish I could clone you, Frank. Who first had the idea for this book? How did it come up, and how did you proceed with it?
So we were just finishing up transferring a lot of the old archives, which were still on videotape from when we started 1991. Lots of those programs were never archived, transferred, digitized, so we could put them on the website. And most of them are there now. So that was a long process. And when we finished that, I thought, what else can I do to reuse the multi-purpose, the TV series? And the book idea just came and I said, hey, Carl, what do you think? And he said, great, let's do it. And we're so excited. Book one, as it's called, right? EnviroVideo Book One, repurposing the TV series as a handbook for action and change. But book one. So in the future episode, future, we'll have book two, and we have three interviews with you.
Who is the book geared for?
Both activists and students, even, and
And for people who aren't, I mean, speaking of books, this is the first book that I wrote on nuclear power, Cover Up What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. And I begin it with you have not been informed about nuclear power. You have not been told. And that has been done on purpose. Keeping the public in the dark was deemed necessary by the promoters of nuclear power if it was to succeed. And then it goes on. Those in government, science, and private industry have been pushing nuclear power, realize that if people were given the facts, if they knew the consequences of nuclear power, they wouldn't stand for it. That book was published in 1980. I began writing it the day the meltdown at Three Mile Island began. A lot of this issue, this nuclear issue, well, it's so dependent on public education. Particularly these days, you see not only Trump, but these Democratic governors, Newsom and Hochul, jumping on this nuclear Well, this new nuclear push, what's necessary, because the nuclear juggernaut has really captured the political system, is for people to learn public education and for them to act. And just let me read from a section of another book, our new book, Enviro Video, Book One. Imagine that the guests on this show, they are speaking not only to me, Carl Grossman, but to you. They are asking you to listen, not passively, but actively. They are asking you to carry their words forward to ensure that truth is not buried, that courage is not forgotten, that hope is not extinguished. This book is not only an archive, it's an invitation to awareness, to responsibility, to action. And that's what this book is all about, a handbook to action based on very, very wise words of some very, very wise people.
I found that in reading the book, there was not a single page that the person speaking was not putting forth what I would consider to be poetry, profound thought, intelligence, action, and hope. All of that was in there in the words of these people. So it's very important that we have this able to walk around with it in our hands. You structured each chapter, each interview with a particular format. You started with a tagline. You went into a transcript of the actual interview, a summary of that interview, and then what people can do, each of those four categories. How did you come to that structure, and what do you hope that it will lead people to do?
The interviews were so dynamic. They all contain, because every interview, Carl will always ask, usually near the end of the interview, what can people do? So the interviews themselves included that. But a lot of these interviews were recorded in the 90s, and there's new things, there's new technologies. So it needed more. And that's how the end part, I'm starting from the end, like after the tagline or the introduction into each interview, the interview, and then we had the summary, and then we had the what people can do. So that what people can do portion includes a lot of the newer technologies and suggestions and things that people could do that weren't available at the time the interview were done, or at least some of those interviews, not all of them, because some of them are new. They're not as old as others. The introduction, interview by interview, listening to the many dynamics of the interview itself, Carl's brilliant questions and commentaries, the interaction with the guests, it set the stage. The introduction tells a little bit of that story of what people are about to read, the significance of it, and it gives them something to do at the same time. They're actively listening. Listen with your heart, not just your ears, and think about what you could do to help. So the whole thing was just structured around that. The summaries, the interviews speak for themselves. They're timeless.
How many interviews are there, and who are some of the people who are included?
There is a total of 14, or three of them had two-parters. Dr. Helen Caldicott had a two-parter, Dr. Mark Jacobson from Stanford University, right? And Mustafa Santiago Ali also had a two-parter. You have Chief Orrin Lyons, who's the faith keeper for the Onondaga Nation, with his words of wisdom from an indigenous person, you know, speaking about the seven generations and their whole philosophy. You have David Fenton. He was a monster in the PR world. He had his own PR firm and wrote a handbook for marketing. He brought his wisdom, and he was involved with lots of environmental, even anti-nuke concerts. So he was just a perfect person to have. And those are just to name a few. I named, what, four or five of the 14 of people that we had.
Some of them have passed, like Dr. George Gould, a Nobel Prize-winning biologist, Dr. Henry Kendall, the founder of the Union of Concerned Scientists, of Vladimir Chernyshenko. He was in charge of the cleanup of the Chernobyl nuclear plant accident scene. And in fact, he's passed. He was dying of cancer. As I did the interview with Dr. Chernosenko, the camera people were crying because these were almost his last words. And more recent interviews, Maya von Rossum, who leads the crusade for a green amendment, having constitutions include an amendment which guarantees a clean, livable environment. Dr. Gordon Edwards, president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, who explains that these so-called new, improved nuclear power plants that are being pushed aren't new at all. It's stuff from decades ago that are being wheeled out. They didn't work then and are not going to work now. So there's a mix of it was very hard selecting those we would feature in the book. And there's so many more that will be featured in future books.
How did you choose out of your 700 plus episodes? How could you whittle it down, or what process did you use to whittle it down to these to start?
It was very, very difficult. We put together lists of 50, 60 people and finally whittled it down to a core group for the first volume. But there's so many very important interviews. And again, the wisdom that was advanced in and this is information you don't get hardly ever on television. In fact, you hardly get it anywhere. We searched out for what's been covered. That's why I called my first book, Cover Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. These are interviews with people who expose what's been covered up. And there sure has been a lot that's been covered up.
Is there a common thread through all of the interviews?
Well, I think the common thread is this is stuff you've not seen otherwise on television. This is information that has been covered up. We're talking about critical issues, life and death issues. For example, I asked Chernosenko, the claim I said is that the problem with regard to Chernobyl was, oh, it's a Soviet design. But in the West, it turns out that Dr. Chernosenko had traveled through the West. And he explains, no, these are issues that involve nuclear power designs all over the world and can lead to nuclear catastrophes all over the world. And I'd say that's the common thread, the suppression of information, the cover-up, what you're not supposed to know about nuclear power, and also nuclear war. We have programs on the consequences, the impacts of nuclear war.
And one other thing I would add is common threads is what viewers, what people can do, because that's always covered in every single episode. There's always a section on that, as we mentioned earlier. And then we embellished on that, expanded on that in the book.
Given the relentless anti-environmentalism and edicts that are coming out of Washington, D.C., presidential orders, laws, how does this impact the kinds of activism that the people in your book are advocating for?
I got into journalism, just a side story in terms of my entry, and it was through an internship at Antioch College at the Cleveland Press. And above the entrance of the Cleveland Press were the words, "Give people the light and they will find their own way." That's what I've tried to do all through my working life as a journalist, to provide that light, believing that you need a modicum of democracy to have this work out. Find their own way and act. And through investigative journalism, I have found that you can provide light. There's a wonderful tradition that used to be called muckraking in this country of investigative reporting, investigative journalism, which has changed things to the better. And in terms of these issues that we've tackled with these very, very wise, intelligent people, so much needs to be done. We have to lift the veil of secrecy, tell people what's going on, what's truly happening, and hope that through democracy, through action, that public education could lead to change for the better.
Carl, you reminded me of one of the videos that we did on food irradiation. And that video was shown at a town hall in the state of Maine. They were taking a vote that night or against food irradiation. And after our video was shown, they voted unanimously against it. So we have that. And Carl, you've written about it, done all these interviews. And when we first launched the book just a few months ago, and we had a launch party celebration of Carl, I had heard so many stories. Libby, you even made a video that was shown at that, and so many others were telling all these wonderful stories. But I learned even more from a lot of people I had never met and heard and that were there just sharing stories about the impact that Carl has had through all of the above, the TV series, the documentaries, the specials, his books, his lecturing, professor at Old Westbury SUNY as investigative journalism professor, and students that I've actually met, one I work with, and they're like, "You work with Carl Gross, Professor Grossman?" She goes, I said, "Yeah." She said, "He helped launch me on this path, and I am so happy and so better at what I do, and I understand journalism in a whole nother way that I wasn't getting anywhere else." So he's had a huge impact from national, states, individuals, and I just wanted to share that. It's beautiful, Carl, and I'm happy we're still going strong, and this is just book one, and we have more to come.
And I need to put in my own kudos to Carl, because when I was new to this movement and just saying, gee, I think I'm doing a podcast, he was one of the people I contacted from out of nowhere. I was scared to call him because it's like he's this big person and I'm just starting out. Never treated me with condescension, always helpful, always a mentor. And actually, it was his response to a query I had about a press release that went out from Trinity that set me on a pathway of 14 years that it's taken to write my play, which is moving forward, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due. So you've had tremendous influence on me and my writing, my career, and the things that are important to me.
That very honored to have a part in that, Libby.
So big. I made you one of the characters in my play because I couldn't do it without you. Do you have a favorite or a most important or a highlighted interview of all of them in the book that you think people absolutely must read?
Extraordinarily important is, and mentioned his name, Dr. Mark Jacobson. He's a professor of environmental engineering at Stanford, and he has written a book, and it's the title of the program we did with him, No Miracles Needed. And the book is about how all the energy we need can be provided by safe, clean, green energy led by solar and wind power. No need for nuclear power, no need for burning a fossil fuel and so forth. I mean, what Dr. Jacobson is telling us is that all this climate change to the effects of radiation on people, injuries and deaths to people living near nuclear power plants, not to mention what has occurred as a result of catastrophes at Three Mile Island, at Fukushima, at Chernobyl. It's all unnecessary. No miracles are needed. It's more than a hopeful message. It's a thoroughly practical message telling us about energy we can live with and how to get there.
And one other thing that Dr. Mark Jacobson is really pushing now, we saw a video, Carl and I were working on a program, and they showed a video of Jacobson, and the very first technology he spoke about, it was hot dry rock, geothermal energy. He wasn't pushing solar, wind, not from the beginning. And I'm hoping that our next interview is going to be with Dr. Jacobson to expand on that. That's always been my favorite too, is the hot dry rock geothermal. But from the book, because I work in the media, it has to be David Fenton, the David Fenton interview. because he is so wise and his words were very powerful and instructive for people that are either starting, the newbies, like you asked, who's this book for? It's also for newbies, but it was also meaningful for a veteran person like myself who's worked in the industry for a long time.
Fenton had just written a book titled The Activist's Media Handbook. And I got a hold of it and got a hold of David Fenton. I mean, he's a guru of how to get information out. The TV show was a kind of a televised version, a video version of his instructions in an activist media handbook, how to, as an activist, best use the media.
We'll return with the second half of this week's featured interview with Carl Grossman and Frank Melli, co-authors of the book EnviroVideo Book 1, Repurposing the TV Series into a Handbook for Action and Change. We'll do so in just a moment, but first, each week, the nuclear industry provides us with new nightmares, but you couldn't tell any of it was happening if all you follow is mainstream media. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat exists, to give a caring, compassionate, and concerned person like you a regular weekly dose of nuclear news you can count on to be honest and verified. Nuclear Hot Seat is the longest-running program anywhere that focuses exclusively on nuclear issues. Now finishing up its 15th year as a podcast and 8th year as a broadcast, we have a long history of scooping mainstream media on nuclear issues, giving context and continuity to local and national stories, and working behind the scenes, providing links and introductions between activists, researchers, and reporters so that our stories get out far beyond this show. You count on Nuclear Hot Seat to provide you with the verifiable, fresh information and an unrelenting perspective every week. So if having this information helps you, and you see the importance of it getting out into the world, we need your help. That would mean a donation of any size. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. That's where you can send a one-time donation of any size or set up an automatic recurring donation of any size, just $5 a month, the same as you would spend here in the U.S. on a cup of coffee. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax deductible. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. So please don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now. And whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's part two of this week's featured interview with Carl Grossman and Frank Melli on their book, EnviroVideo Book 1, Repurposing the TV Series into a Handbook for Action and Change. Frank, I understand that you put together a surprise for me, and I'm here and waiting to be surprised, so go for it.
This morning, I edited for you highlights in order by appearance in the book of 30 to 45 seconds for each person, sound bites, the best sound bite from each of them, the most powerful sound bite, and put them all together. It's all edited cleanly. Audio mix is all good for you. So we can play it and we can come back and you can comment on it.
Let's give it a go now.
I think it's high time to realize by now. The whole nuclear enterprise represents a wrong turn in human history. Both the power, nuclear power and nuclear weapons. This is a technology that's not tameable, not tameable. The whole world is waiting for the next big catastrophe. And everyone, including everyone in that business, knows that the next one is coming.
It was clear that something had to be done. The nuclear arms race was beginning to run out of control. The Soviet Union and the United States were in the midst of building enough nuclear weapons, hydrogen bombs, to fry the Earth.
For one thing, the truth is that it's the first truly international nuclear disaster in the world. which gave us, I mean, scientists, the opportunity to understand for the first time the truly colossal consequences and dangers of the use of nuclear power. A disaster at a nuclear plant in one country is enough to destroy not only that country, but the entire world. And we're very worried about that.
This is all over the globe. This is a global problem. These chemicals get in there and they bind right to the receptors in the body. And they turn them on at the wrong time, or they turn them off, or they block them so that the developing embryo doesn't get the right message.
Nuclear power is a carcinogenic industry. There's no way to store this radioactive waste, which must be isolated from the ecosphere for a million years. So we will get epidemics for the rest of time of cancer, leukemia, and genetic diseases. So nuclear power equals, in my mind, random compulsory genetic engineering for the rest of time.
The early stages of global warming are marked by a much more unstable climate, by more severe and intense downpours, more floods and droughts and severe storms and temperature extremes and sea level rise. That is happening now.
And from him, I begin to learn the power that exists within the atom, the power to do good or the power to literally blow up the earth. This technology is the power of the sun. The question is, are we mature enough to handle the cosmic power that lights up the universe and lights up the galaxies? I have my doubts.
It's not class in America that determines where pollution is sited, but it's really race. It's race that is really the determining factor of whether or not your community gets targeted for a polluting facility or a landfill or any of these kinds of noxious land uses.
I see it as an addiction. Nuclear weapons are an addiction. We need the help of millions of ordinary people to see the common sense of making a sustainable planet that is not putting itself on the road to perdition, on the road to annihilation. And the danger is that in the pursuit of power, electrical power and political power and technological power, we may in fact imperil the entire planet.
The instructions that we've been given is to ensure the welfare of those coming generations by long-term thinking and long-term care. Our responsibility then is a continuance of what we have, a securing of what we have, a respect for what we have.
A Green Amendment is an amendment that gets placed in the Bill of Rights section of our state and federal constitutions and recognizes and protects the rights to clean water, clean air, a stable climate, and healthy environments in the same most powerful legal and constitutional way that we recognize and protect the other human, civil, and political rights we hold dear, like the rights to free speech.
It is environmental racism because we know that the policies of the past help to frame and to actually accelerate many of these impacts that we are currently seeing in Black and Brown and Indigenous communities. We know that race is a stronger predictor of how long you're going to live and what you're going to be impacted by than income is. So the environmental racism aspect is not only true, but is apparent, and you can trace policy to many of these impacts that are going on.
We have the technologies we need and the costs have come down. We do have a lot of pushback by the fossil fuel companies. You know, so there's a lot of misinformation, but there's also a lot of lobbying.
Facts don't work on their own. Facts only work when they're embedded in stories. Stories have to have good characters and bad characters. So if you're not embedding the truth in stories that have a moral and emotional aspect and dimension, no one hears you.
Wow. That is so inspirational. And there wasn't a single one of those quotes that you came up with that wasn't impactful in its own right. For the record, in order, those speakers were Nobel laureate George Wald, Henry Kendall of the Union of Concerned Scientists on the Birth of Scientific Activism, Vladimir Cherisenko, through an interpreter, with The Truth About Chernobyl, Dr. Theo Colburn of World Wildlife Fund, Dr. Helen Caldicott, the mother of us all, Ross Gelbspan, an investigative journalist talking about climate change denial, Michio Kaku, the anti-nuclear physicist, Cecil Corbin Mark, on grassroots organizing in Harlem and environmental justice as a civil rights issue, Dr. Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility on citizen science and public education, Orrin Lyons, Indigenous Leadership and Ecological Ethics, Maya K. von Rossum on the Green Amendment, Mustafa Santiago Ali of the World Wildlife Federation, talking about environmental justice and community empowerment, Dr. Mark Jacobson on how existing technologies can decarbonize the world without waiting for breakthroughs, no miracles needed, and David Fenton, who wrote the Activist Media Handbook on Law, Communications, and Movement Strategy. I think this condensed sizzle reel should give people a sense of how rich the material is within this book, how immediately applicable to the problems that we're facing, what we are trying to do in getting rid of nukes and everything that they have left behind in their wake. Makes me want to read the book one more time. Let me ask you about strategies. There is a tactic that I think we might be able to use, and I just want to put this out for discussion, and that is the link between the pushback against AI and the fact that nuclear is being proposed to be the power to run AI, and that since there is such a groundswell of activism against artificial intelligence data centers and what they would do with local communities, it would be worth our while to see if we can link that to a push against nuclear. Because even if AI can be pushed away for a period of time, you know, they're going to be relentless. They're going to keep coming back until they get what they want. And we're going to have to stop them every time. But if in the interim, these small modular nuclear reactors are allowed to be established, 5 years down the line, 8 years down the line, whatever it is, they can say, well, we can do AI now because, look, you've got nuclear here already. So perforce, if someone is against AI, we need to also have them understand that they need to be against nuclear because that would set the groundwork for, in the future, AI being approved and being allowed to get into operation. Your thoughts on that?
First of all, former U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, she has, this is just recent, said that these data centers shouldn't be allowed unless powered by renewable energy. There's no need for nuclear to do AI. So let's uncouple that connection. And then in terms of proceeding on with AI, we must do it super carefully. Amory Lovins has also jumped in on this issue, talking about the practicality of energizing AI or these data centers through renewables.
Frank, you wrote to me saying, one of the things I want to talk about is how you and others can easily turn your programs, for example, Nuclear Hot Seat, into a book series. Given that you've already gone through this and this book was self-published, how did you proceed? How did you do it? And are you available to help me?
I'll help you and all of your listeners right now. It's a simple, fast process. If you have basic editing skills, and if not, you could just go on YouTube and ask, how do I do this? How do I do that? And what we're talking about specifically is from your audio podcast, you have it as an audio file. You drop that into the editing software and you generate a transcript. You can also download from YouTube or wherever you have it. Many of the websites give you automatic transcripts. So once you've generated that transcript, you export it. So then all you need to do is to write an introduction to each interview, like we did with this book, Enviro Video Book 1. And you write a summary to that interview, give some additional pointers, like what people can do, like we did, or some other angles that might be more meaningful to you or to your audience. And you would then design the book based on that process. And then you just take, like we did, the top 15 to 17 interviews, and you write the introduction to it based on all 15 to 17 interviews once you've chosen them all. So there's your introduction to the whole book, and then to the first interview, an individual introduction. And that's it. You do a closing to the book, and you write that part yourself as well. It's pretty basic, simple, and fast. Does that pretty much give you an idea?
It's a definite possibility. It's not anything that I haven't thought of before, but that hasn't been my focus. I'm now generating transcripts for each week's Nuclear Hot Seat and trying to work back in time to get earlier ones as well, because this is a recent evolution in my skill set. But transcripts are now available. I am about to launch a YouTube channel, which I'm already preloading with a number of episodes. So there will be a chunk of them up there once it becomes available. And all of this is pointing towards the next evolution, which would be, yeah, why not a book? So if there's anyone with those skills who would like to help me with it, thank you very much. I would welcome the outreach. Now, the book is published. Where can people go to get it?
To envirovideo.com, envirovideo.com.
And we will, of course, link to it on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode. Is there anything that we haven't covered yet that you would like to add at this time?
The written word is enormously important. An old editor of mine, Dave Starr, spoke about how morning newspapers would survive because maybe not afternoon or evening ones, but morning ones, because people wake up in the morning and when they see it written, they have confidence in it. That's why a combination of media is so important. Video is very important because it can transmit emotion, feeling, better than, unless you're talking about poetry, something written. Audio is important because it's sort of a combination between the power of the written word and the way video is, in media theory, maybe non-cognitive, it's called, but does emit emotion, and it's good for people to feel. A TV documentary is really a lot about emotion. So I think how we need to proceed is in all forms of media, but realize that the written word, that's why books are so important. And in this particular case, a book is a transcript of audio interviews, enhances the words spoken, and listened to is great. To be read is great.
Frank, any last thoughts you'd like to add?
Yeah, there's just a little paragraph here that I'd like to read from the book, which reads, "The world will not change through information alone. It will change when information becomes inspiration and inspiration becomes action." That is the passage this book invites you to take. That really is the essence of this book. And, you know, like Carl said, those words over his first job there, was that an internship, Carl, or was that a job? The words.
It was an internship at Antioch College.
And the words said, show people the light and they can find their way. And that's about action, isn't it?
One last thought as you're providing all of this inspiration for us. When can we look forward to book two?
I hope as soon as we can put it together, choosing again some of these brilliant people that I've interviewed and their brilliant comments, their brilliant words, their brilliant advice.
There's so much inspiration there. Originally, Carl had given me two lists for the first two books, and the first list was not enough for the first book. So I borrowed a few from the second book list and we added those. We still have now what's left over from that second book list, and we need to expand on it and get started on that. And I would say as soon as the effects of this interview, like you're doing, our hope is that some people will learn about it through your program and actually buy the book, tell other people about it. They may buy it also. And once we have some sales, and I need to do some more marketing. If you don't have a budget for advertising and marketing, there are many things that we can do on our own. And that's where we are right now. And I've been putting lists of these great ideas and running them back and forth with Carl. As soon as some of those start getting implemented and start getting results, whatever length of time that that takes, that's when we're going to start writing the second book.
Let me just stress the subtitle to the book. The title is EnviroVideo Book One, but the subtitle is Repurposing the TV Series into a Handbook for action and change. And it's a lot more repurposing that should be done.
I personally believe that we should be buying copies of these and sending them to everybody in DC, our representatives, our senators, our state, our local officials, so that they at least have the opportunity to learn the information that's in here, because virtually any one of them could turn someone around on this issue. Again, the book is Enviro Video, Book 1, Repurposing the TV Series into a Handbook for Action and Change, and the two men who are behind it, Carol Grossman and Frank Melli, I want to thank you so much for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you very much, Libby.
I thank you as well, Libby, and thanks for all that you do. You are a rock star in this arena, and I'm so happy to hear part of it came from the inspiration you got from Carl, who, as I said earlier, it's such an honor for me as well to be able to work with the great Carl Grossman.
Award-winning environmental journalist Carl Grossman and his producer, media activist and strategist Frank Melli. They're the team behind the long-running program Enviro Close-Up, and they shared about their new book, which is based on interviews from that show. It's called Enviro Video Book 1, Repurposing the TV Series into a Handbook for Action and Change. We'll have the link up to that book on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 778. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 26, 2026. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest thing in the world. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. You cannot miss the yellow opt-in box, which asks you to put in your first name and an email address. Send that back to us, and every week you will get one, count them, one email, which contains the link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of its content. That way, you need never miss a single update to the world's nuclear news. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and click on that red donate button, we will so appreciate it. Any amount will help us out and will earn you a huge thank you as we keep the show running. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2026, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, silence in the face of tyranny isn't neutrality, it's collaboration. That from the esteemed journalist Edward R. Murrow. So there you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. Whatever you do now, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the Nuclear Hot Seat.
Nuclear Hot Seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear Hot Seat. It's da bomb.